Saddle up, hombres, and join the film swap pussy for a ride along the dusty trails of the Sierras of southern Spain and the Italian Dolomites in search of two spectacular spaghetti westerns. Tonight on Film Swap Podcast.
Here is a motion picture film. Let's tidy up this tangle of film by putting it on a reel.
Listeners, and welcome to Film Swap. My name is David Seeley, and this most ecstatic gaucho is the ecstatic gaucho himself, Mr. Jonathan Pritchard Barrett. Jonathan, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Very appropriate today's discussion, because we're talking about not gauchos, the South American cowboys, but cowboys, the North American cowboys.
Well, we go a little bit south. There's some Mexican. There's a Mexican angle in there.
I guess there is. Yes,
there is.
Not as far as Argentina, though.
So, how are you? You've been on a little holiday since last we spoke. How did that all go?
I have. I went up to York, which is a terrific place to visit with a sort of young family, and lots of things for kids to do, including the Jorvik Viking Centre. And Jorvik is the Viking name for York when it was sort of ruled over by the Vikings about 1,000 or sort of 1,100 years ago, something like that. And it's fascinating. One of the interesting artifacts they have there, I don't know if it's an artifact, is the Lloyds Bank coprolite, which is a fossilized poo, which is a Viking fossilized poo. And they found it when doing an excavation, and it gave them some insight into what the Vikings were eating, or at least one particular Viking, mostly bread and meat in his case, apparently.
Oh, wow. Yeah, somehow that doesn't seem surprising. But so where is the Lloyds Bank angle? Is that they've sponsored the poo?
Well, they should do, but they didn't know. They were excavating a sort of some old sort of factory site or something in order to build a new Lloyds Bank in 1970. And it has its own Wikipedia page, should you be interested. Perhaps we can include that in the show notes. Yeah, so anyway, that was just one of the many interesting things. The National Railway Museum, if you like steam trains and locomotives and whatnot. There's lots of that up there. And yeah.
So it sounds like you had an action-packed holiday.
It was action-packed, yes. Yep.
And I guess from talking about Vikings tonight, we're actually not talking about Vikings. We're talking about cowboys.
We are cowboys.
Wow. But not just normal cowboys. We're talking about Italian cowboys. Or actually, more appropriately, because, of course, tonight the theme of our show is spaghetti westerns.
Yep.
But, of course, a lot of spaghetti westerns weren't necessarily Italian. They were maybe made in Italy, but they were usually quite often co-productions, weren't they, between sort of France and Germany, where westerns were really, really popular. So they were kind of always co-productions and quite often had international casts.
We did.
That featured you know, American stars and French film stars and Italian film stars and all sorts of stars from all over the world.
Yeah, that's true. But I learned today when I was researching spaghetti westerns, because they're obviously famous for being shot in Spain. Apparently the first foreign western to be shot in Spain was actually a British film. Can you believe it?
Oh, right.
Yeah, didn't realize that. So.
And what was that one called?
The Sheriff of Fractured Jaw, which was a sort of...
have you heard of that? Great title.
It's a great title. Directed by Raoul Walsh, starring Kenneth Moore, British Kenneth Moore, and Jane Mansfield, American Jane Mansfield. And so, and then the next one after that was Savage Guns, which was a British-Spanish one. film, also filmed in Spain. But yeah, so it's actually the Spanish trend started with the British, weirdly.
Right. So when you say Spanish, do you mean Italian?
Well, I mean, so many of these Spanish, well, these spaghetti westerns were filmed in Almeria, weren't they, in the sort of southern region of Spain. Yeah. So it does make it a bit confusing. You think, wait a second, the spaghetti westerns, surely it should be a paella or paella western.
Hmm. Well, it's interesting to get the I guess, if you talk about the spaghetti western, I guess it was a terminology that was just sort of, you know, put on them by critics and things because they were basically referring to European-made Westerns rather than American Westerns.
Yeah.
And I guess really the trend really started because the Italian film industry very much, they like to jump, they like to jump on trends. So when it came time to, you know, it'd be before the spaghetti Westerns, it was a huge sort of a cycle of what they called sword and sandal epics, which were, you know, sort of Roman, you know, toga wearing, sword fighting and big muscle bound Hercules type characters throwing pillars around and, you know, gods and, you know, things like that. And there's some terrific examples of that. Perhaps in another episode, we'll talk about them.
Yeah.
But then the spaghetti, after A Fistful of, was it A Fistful of Dollars, a remake of Yojimbo?
Yes.
Sergio Leone made a remake of the Japanese classic Yojimbo, set in the Old West with a TV actor called Clint Eastwood, which some people might have heard of. Yep. And that film, aside from making Clint Eastwood a massive, huge movie star, and it was a phenomenal sort of massive success, it also started the so-called spaghetti western you know, cycle of films that kind of lasted from sort of the mid to late 60s up until sort of the, it kind of petered out, I guess, in the sort of mid to late 70s, really.
Right.
So and there's a lot of them.
Right.
And what it's always interests me, because quite often I've had conversations with people or I've read in articles and things where sometimes people refer to spaghetti westerns a bit disparagingly. Mm. I think there is a certain train of thought that somehow these are sort of inferior somehow to American westerns.
Yeah.
And things like that. But I don't agree with that at all. I love spaghetti westerns. It's actually a real favorite genre of mine.
Yeah.
Mainly because they're a lot different than the American films. They have a different tone to them.
Yep.
They're a little bit more sort of counterculture. They have, they're a little bit more sort of, they have ambiguous heroes rather than sort of the good guys and the bad guys. And they have, you know, a little bit more sort of nuance in terms of the psychology of the characters and you know, morality of the characters. And they can be a good conduit for some social criticism and observations as well. I think we've picked a couple of real, real classics tonight, real brilliant films. I think maybe we tell the audience about them, shall we?
That's a good idea, actually.
So, shall I start with mine tonight? I think we'll start with mine.
Yes.
My film, I actually only just sort of recently saw it. It was one that I was sort of familiar with, but I only actually never sat down and watched it. And it's a 1968 film from Enzo G. Castellari, who was, again, a sort of a great Italian director who made all sorts of different types of films. But he is quite famous for his Westerns. And this particular one stars the great Chuck Connors, iron-jawed, you know, He-Man. It's called Kill Them All and Come Back Alone, which is an amazing title.
It's a great title. I mentioned it to a colleague at work, and they said, what? Kill them all and come back home alone? No, not Home Alone.
Not Home Alone, no. No,
but, yeah, great,
no relation to Home Alone. But it's definitely, it's got an amazing cast in it. And oddly enough, it stars an American actor called Frank Wolf, who's actually in both films that we're going to talk about
tonight. Yes, yes.
And it is a, and I'm sure you'll agree with me here, Jonathan, an absolutely rip-roaring, action-packed, and it's a kind of a heist film as well, isn't it?
It is. It is. I guess it is a bit of a heist film, yeah.
Yeah, so
that's what it is, really.
Yeah. It's absolutely just a very exciting and interesting film, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But Jonathan, what film did you pick tonight?
Well, the film I chose is The Great Silence, and this one is also from 1968, directed by the great Sergio Corbucci, and the other one of the three big Sergios in Spaghetti Western. For some reason, they're all direct, not all, but three principal directors have this first name. Anyway, it stars the great, what's his name? Jean-Louis Trintignant, who is, sorry, any French listeners or anybody who knows how to pronounce it properly. But anyway, we've actually had one of his films before, haven't we? The Eric Rohmer one, one of the Christmas ones.
Yes, that's right. My Night at Maud's.
My Night at Maud's, yeah.
He was hanging out with Maud.
He was, indeed.
Christmas.
And also Klaus Kinski, we've already had as well in Fitzcarraldo. The great Klaus Kinski. He's
absolutely brilliant in this one as well.
Yes, he is really, really good. Yeah, and Frank Wolf, Vernetta McGee, and a number of other sort of supporting characters. And it's a terrific movie. I first heard about it, I think when Django Unchained came out, Quentin Tarantino's one of his westerns, and he mentioned it as a sort of massive, or the director in this film in particular, as a sort of massive influence. I think there's a bit in that where he's trudging through the snow, Django. Yes. And
yes, absolutely. And his what is it called, The Hateful Eight, I think owes a lot to some of these films as well.
Exactly.
And actually Sergio Corbucci actually directed Django. The original
Django,
exactly. Western with Frank Nero, which again is absolutely just a great, great film, and well, we're seeking out as well. But we're not talking about that one tonight.
We're not,
because we again here on Film Swap, we try and pick things that are a little bit more off the main path, and I think Django is quite a well recognized classic film. So
yes,
we kind of chose to not talk about that one tonight. But I definitely urge listeners, if you've never seen that one before, to go and seek it out, because it is absolutely great.
Yeah, it's we're sticking with The Great Silence, which is a film that really everyone should see. I think anybody who likes westerns and movies.
So, well, we're going to talk about The Great Silence. In the second half of the show, and it won't be silent. There'll be quite a lot of noise that we'll be making when we talk about it. And that is coming up in the second half of the show. But first, we are going to talk about Kill Them All and Come Back Alone.
Not Home Alone, not Come Back Home Alone. Sorry. Stop that joke. I will never crack
it. Nothing to do with Home Alone, thankfully. So this film, Chuck Connors plays a soldier who is assigned the task of going to steal a shipment of gold bullion.
Is he a soldier? I thought he was sort of like a... He's like a mercenary or a sort of freewheeling character. He's employed by the Confederates during the Civil War to steal bullion from the Union side, isn't he? But I don't think he's an actual Confederate.
I don't know. I got the impression that he was a soldier. At some point, he was a soldier.
Maybe.
And then he ended up maybe falling afoul of the law or something. Or he, he's selling himself out. I mean, the whole idea is he's really... He's quite a morally ambiguous character. Like I was saying, a lot of Westerns are like that. He's not like a clear-cut sort of good guy. He's actually kind of a bit of a nasty piece of work, as are he assembles, much like a heist film, he assembles a crew of sort of murderous thugs of various sort of skills, and he gets them together, and they plan to go and rob this gold. And along the way, there's all, and sorry, the title, I should clarify, comes from the fact that the Confederate general, are they generals or at least, or
sort one's of, a general. A general is the guy who gives him the orders.
Yeah, and they kind of sit him down and they say, look, I want you guys to go and steal this gold, and then I want you to kill all the other guys. Yeah. Just come back alone with the
your accomplices. Kill them all is not the sort of the unionists, or you're not unionists, the union, the sort of forces, but they're actually his accomplices and come back alone. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So he assembles this crew, and it's some great, great characters like Franco Citi, who's one of the Pasolini regulars, and is a terrific presence, and he plays quite a nimble sort of, you know, acrobatic sort of, he somersaults over things and jumps and dives over things, and then sort of punches people in the face a lot. Ken Wood, Hercules Cortez, who was he's the big burly guy who's literally super strong, and he can just like pick like three guys up at a time and toss them 20 feet across the room.
Yes. The character's name is Bogart, but the actor's name is Hercules, and he is a sort of Herculean type character. In fact, it's almost as if he wandered in from one of those sword and sandals epics. The sort of.
Well, apparently he was a professional wrestler.
So was he?
Because he definitely was he's an awfully big bloke.
He was, definitely. He's great. He's Spanish as well.
Interesting. Yeah. So, and then we had another character, Alberto Del Equa, and he was an actor and stuntman, and he's just a young guy. And again, he's a bit vicious. I think, was he the knife thrower? Because there was a couple. There was one guy, they said he was like an Indian and Mexican mix.
I think that's,
knives around.
That's Ken Wood. He's called Blade, the one with the knives, I think, must be.
Yeah, and he was quite like he's quite a big sort of husky guy as well, and he was quite good with his fists and quite nimble and stuff as well.
Yeah.
So they have this sort of group of characters that that Chuck Connors has gathered together to pull this job.
Yeah.
And at the beginning of the film starts out with it's just straight action straight from the get go, because what they do is they actually come and infiltrate the Union army base, or whatever you would call it, I guess the little sort of town or something that they've set up, and they just show them attacking it at the beginning and sort of sneaking in, and then it transpires that this is just like a test, just so that he can show off that he's capable of sneaking into places and beating everybody up and
throwing
stuff up and everything. So the film, it just goes from one set piece to the other, and it kind of reminded me a lot of sort of kind of 80s and 90s kind of action films, because there is all these big huge set pieces of like there's a lot of fisticuffs, a lot of knife fights and gun fights, and it is just sort of straight wall-to-wall action, and a lot of it sort of seems like sort of a little bit ahead of its time in terms of how the fight sequences are laid out. And that's why I say it kind of reminded me a bit of later, sort of, you know, in the 80s and early 90s, when we had all the sort of Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sylvester Stallone sort of action films. It kind of reminded me a bit of that a little bit.
Right. Yeah.
In terms of some of those sequences.
Yes. Did it not remind you a little bit of, say, 60s Batman as well?
Well, there was no sort of pows and socks and things like that coming up on screen.
But the sort of punch sound effects were quite sort of similar, I think. but lots of stuff. And sort of all yeah, lots of sort of backflips and front roly polies and front flips and all yeah. sorts of swinging from chandeliers or sort of swinging from cartwheel chandeliers and extraordinary stuff like this, wearing with great big sideboards as well at the same time.
Yeah, and what struck me really, and I don't know if this had to do a little bit with the sort of the color correction on the Blu-ray that I watched, but yeah. all these guys had incredibly deep, dark tans, didn't they? They were just proper sun-baked, you know, really dark brown.
Amazingly sort of, yeah, exactly. Yeah,
so they clearly were spending a lot of time out in the sun during the filming of this because they were all really proper bronzed, tanned skin, especially yeah. Chuck Connors, just really, really good tans.
And Chuck Connors also has amazingly white teeth,
doesn't he? He does indeed. It's, yeah. It's quite and all these book. Characters, I think, you know, I mean, I loved watching Franco Citti, especially because, like I say, he's quite well, I think, best known for, he's in quite a lot of Pasolini's films.
Yeah.
And you see a completely different side of him because he's this real proper nasty piece of work. And he's very nimble and athletic, and he's running and jumping and diving over stuff and hopping up on horses and
yeah.
you know, jumping off of roofs and doing flips and, you know, so it's just sort of, he's a proper action man in this, as they all are.
Yeah.
So that's just sort of something I wouldn't have necessarily associated with him as an actor in a lot of the films that I've seen him in previously.
Yeah.
So that was a kind of a nice surprise because it's kind of a very fun role. It looks like they're all having a blast making this film, really. It just looked like it was great.
Yeah.
Great fun.
Yeah, definitely. Although
very sweaty.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, the dripping wet infiltrators is one thing I wrote down. Not sure if that's the sweat or the fact that somebody just dunked themselves in a sort of horse, what do you call it? Bath or something like that.
And what did you think of the sort of the angle about the title refers to this, as I mentioned, this instruction that he's been given that, you know, you get the gang together, you go and pull this robbery, bring the gold back, we just kill all the other guys so we don't have to, you know, so they don't know anything, so nobody knows what happened and,
yeah.
you know, you can't trace it, and then we don't have to split the gold up with them. So it's like quite a nasty sort of, cynical exercise, yes. isn't it?
In
morality.
It is. Yes. I was surprised when it said kill them all and come back alone. I'd assumed when I just knew the title before watching it that he was going to go somewhere and kill all his opponents, the baddies, or whatever they were, and then come back on his own. I didn't realize, you know. That he was going to be killing his own colleagues, well, the rest of his gang. Yeah, that was a bit of, but in a sense that I'll give a bit of a spoiler. Watch out if you want to watch it. They do all die, but he doesn't exactly kill them. He doesn't mind too much that they've died, does he?
Well, this is the thing. They're not really friends, are they? And that's what's kind of the film has a really interesting vibe because it does really have that sense of kind of like overall, it's every man for himself, really. And even yeah. though there's a kind of a loose camaraderie, I mean, yeah. obviously they work well together and they're quite a tight-knit group. And again, without spoiling anything directly, there's one of the characters does come to a bit of a sticky end at one yep. point, and he does sort of say, like, what's the matter with you guys? We're friends.
Right.
But then, of course, they're not friends at all, as it turns out. None of them really seem to be particularly close or you know, have that sort of, you know, brotherhood and everything that you would expect in a sort of, I guess I would say, in an American film or a different – type of film where you would have clear-cut good guys and they're all working together to for a common goal and they're sticking together and they have each other's back and stuff like that. But this film kind of plays with that a little bit in the sense that everyone ultimately is just worried about getting rich. And
Well, it's like that story that I mentioned from Chaucer, the Pardoner's Tale, where they meet this old man who says, over there, there's gold. They go over and look under the tree. There's three men, and they find the gold. And then two of them decide to go back, or one of them goes back to, one of them goes back to the town to pick up some food and wine for them all to get sort of pissed with this new, and have a party with this sort of, with their new gold. And he decides to poison the wine. He comes back. They kill him. They think, well, there's now two of us enjoying all this gold rather than one of us. And then they drink the wine and they all die. That's sort of what happens when you get gold, essentially. It's like a sort of fable. And I guess it's a sort of similar thing, isn't it? And is the Treasure of the Sierra Madre, is that a bit like that?
A little bit. I mean, that's kind of, you know, about greed, I guess. And they all find this gold, and then ultimately they all end up falling out. But it's a bit different in the sense that they all kind of start out as great pals, great friends, and then it shows how greed kind of tears that apart and sort of overcomes that.
Yeah.
Whereas this one, there's kind of a real sense, there's a real cynicism that runs through the film, I think.
Yeah.
And even the Frank Wolf character who kind of sends him on the assignment, and then it turns out he just sort of, you know, at the beginning he's a Union soldier and he gives him this task to go and steal this money, and then later on it transpires that he's actually kind of like a double agent.
Yeah.
And he actually is working for the Confederate soldiers as well.
No, it's and the other way around.
I get my Civil War stuff all muddled up quite often.
But it was funny that sort of change of uniform. You think, well, who is this guy? Where does he fit in then? And it's in a sense he's just another sort of character out for himself as well, I guess, isn't he?
He's kind of playing both sides, and at one point they kind of end up in like this kind of prison camp or doing this kind of work camp, don't they?
Yeah.
And he, you know, sort of tries to pit them all off of each other, don't they, to find out where they've, because this is sort of post after the sort of heist that they've done. And then the gold gets hidden somewhere, and only if he doesn't know who knows where it is and who doesn't.
Yeah.
So he just basically pits them all against each other psychologically, and then sort of sets them all up to see who will betray who first, or and stuff like that. So it becomes a little bit of a kind of a cat and mousey kind of game in that sense. So
who works for who, and who, it's all confusing.
Well,
keeps you guessing.
So, the reason I picked this film, aside from the fact that I only just recently saw it for the first time and just thought it was terrific, terrific piece of entertainment.
Yep.
But it also, and aside from some of these nuances that I've talked about, I just thought the film was a, because it's kind of one that isn't sort of as well known, and it is quite entertaining. And like I say, it's quite sort of a real rips, snorting sort of action adventure, lots and lots of, you know, just real, it just moves at a really quick pace and has lots of super action and stuff.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily like a massively deep film in terms of analyzing it or anything, but I think it's just really, really entertaining.
Yeah.
And just something that I thought would be worth drawing people's attention to as a more off the beaten track example of the spaghetti Western and about the types of the films that came out of Europe, genre films.
Yeah.
So, was there anything else in particular that you wanted to talk about?
No. Well, I guess the character, yeah, Frank Wolfe, who later appears sort of in the Great Silence. That he's an interesting actor. He was an American that had sort of moved to Europe to sort of basically ended up in all these spaghetti westerns. I guess they needed Americans for them. One of the things I should say is that it's in English or dubbed into English. Whereas The Great Silence, I watched actually in Italian. I didn't realize, because my DVD or Blu-ray, it just the default option is in Italian, which was a bit of a surprise. I was expecting it to be in English or at least dubbed into English. So this one is, I think, primarily in, I guess they would have had an Italian version. But,
Oddly, a lot of these Italian films were always post-synced. They didn't. It's sort of as a cost-saving measure, I think, more than anything.
Yeah,
they used to shoot them without sync sound, and also because they quite often had international casts.
Right,
they would have, as I said earlier on, they would have American actors and German actors and Italian actors and French actors. And sometimes they would even be, the different actors would be speaking their own languages.
Oh, really?
Or if it was, say, a French actor, but he was speaking English because his accent might have been quite heavy.
Yeah.
They would always post-dub these films afterwards.
Okay.
So it's kind of different, whereas, because I'm kind of anti-dubbing, like if I'm watching a foreign language film, I'll usually default to the original language and subtitles so that I'm hearing the actors speak in their proper voices and you're getting the normal inflections that they used and stuff.
Yeah.
Whereas, and I kind of feel the same way too often about sort of some Hong Kong films, like martial arts films and things, is that I'm quite happy to watch the English dub because a lot of the times all these films were post-synced and so you're not hearing the original audio that was recorded anyway. And some of the people will be talking in one language and some people will be talking another. So it kind of doesn't matter which one you watch.
Right.
Because what you're hearing is not the actual sync sound that was recorded on set.
Okay. Must have been quite a bizarre feeling being on the sort of set of one of these films where everybody talking in different languages. And you knew that when it was turned into a finished product, they'd all be speaking in one language.
Yeah. And what's interesting, sometimes the English actors might have gone and recorded their own audio for the film,
right?
And then sometimes not. Sometimes they'd have another voice actor do their voice.
Okay.
So when you talk about The Great Silence, like Klaus Kinski, obviously he can speak. He could speak English, and he did some films where he spoke English.
Yeah.
But in The Great Silence, another actor is dubbing his voice in English.
Okay.
And they probably chose to do that because of the accent.
Right.
So that if they're thinking about the American market, obviously people were less tolerant about those kinds of things back then. So they probably said, well, we don't want him talking with a German accent, so we'll get someone to record his voice.
But then presumably in the Italian one that I watched, his voice was dubbed into Italian as well.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. I don't know because I watched the English version.
But
I don't know, because I'm quite sure Klaus Kinski, he was a very clever guy, and he probably could speak more than, he could probably.
I think he spoke four languages, I saw somewhere. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, I would be surprised if he didn't know at least some Italian and French and all sorts of other languages. So potentially he could, and he made films all over the world as well, didn't he?
Yeah.
So presumably he theoretically could have done the dialogue in Italian or whatever, as the case may be. But I guess for whatever reason, I guess because they were quite often thinking about selling the films overseas to other markets. So I guess they would factor those things in the decision making. Yeah. And you can see sometimes, like when people are talking, you could see they're talking English and the audio syncs with their what they're saying. But right. you can also tell that it isn't the, you know, live sound that would have been recorded, you know, when they were in the middle of the desert or in that saloon or whatever. So anyway, that's an interesting little bit of information to point out to someone who's maybe not familiar with a lot of these films.
Well, I'm not the world's greatest expert on spaghetti westerns. So I did find out that in Japan, apparently they're called macaroni westerns.
Macaroni, yes. Yeah.
Interesting film. And I wasn't sure at the beginning, does Chuck Connors, who I'd never heard of before, does he look like Henry Fonda or does he look like Clint? I wasn't sure. He's got this very chiseled look, hasn't he?
He does indeed.
What does he look like?
Again, you said you weren't very familiar with him, but I think primarily. I think it's probably fair to say that he was, much like Clint Eastwood, he kind of started out on television. He kind of became famous for starring in a Western TV series called The Rifleman. And then a lot of these actors, after their series ended, they were kind of, you know, recognizable stars from being on television and things.
Right.
But they weren't necessarily big movie stars. And so a lot of them ended up going over to Europe and being in these types of films.
Right.
And then in the case of Clint Eastwood, it actually ended up sort of being a huge boon to his career. And he became a huge film star and director and everything. Chuck Connors, I think he did. I'm just sort of giving him a quick look over his CV. And I mean, it looks like he was a professional baseball player.
Yeah, and basketball.
The Brooklyn Dodgers before he became an actor.
Yeah.
Then he became, after his sports career, then he started working in television.
Yeah.
Then came The Rifleman, and then a lot of Western TV shows and things after that.
Yeah.
And then he kind of moved into doing the odd film here and there.
Yeah. Amazing.
And he's got quite a big filmography, and he was working right up until 1992 was the last film he made.
Right.
3 Days to a Kill.
That's when he died.
Because there's another credit here that says a Man Who Fell from the Sky, 2001, but it just says he was the narrator and host. That's interesting because he died in 1992, so I don't know how he managed
that. How they managed that?
The 2001 was the release.
Yeah.
Perhaps he had already, you know, perhaps it was sitting on the shelf for a few years before it.
Yeah. Sounds like.
And I mean, he did a lot of television, a huge amount of television.
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, he was quite a well known, I think, sort of personality.
Yes.
And he definitely in this film, he played a lot of tough guy roles, a lot of sort of big, you know, sort of cops and cowboys and things like that. He had great teeth.
He'd had amazing teeth, especially when he was super tanned, like in this one, where they really, the contrast is super apparent. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think he was terrific in this, and because he had that sort of slightly, you know, he gave off like that slightly sort of sleazy kind of vibe, didn't he? Of like someone who's a little bit sort of
sort of cheeky as well.
Cheeky, yeah, cheeky, and sort of, you know, a bit you could kind of see him stabbing people in the back to walk off with the loot kind of thing.
He's a ne'er-do-well, I'd say.
Yeah. But anyway, folks, I think we might move on to The Great Silence. I'll just mention Kill Them All and Come Back Alone. You should definitely go and find it because it is a really great, entertaining film. It's available on Blu-ray from Studio Canal as part of their cult classics line.
Yeah.
So that's what the cover looks like. And it is really terrific. And I got to say, too, that Studio Canal, they're not exactly known in the film collecting community for their really great transfers.
Yeah.
But in this case, this Blu-ray is excellent. It's really, 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 really good transfer of the film. It looks great.
I watched it on Prime, Amazon Prime, but through Studio Canal because they have a Studio Canal. But I didn't want to sign up for a sort of subscription, so I just rented it, and which was good. But it's also, I think, on Google Film and also on YouTube movies as well.
And Apple TV as well, I noticed. Because when I always, before I recommend the film, I always check out to see how accessible it's going to be for you in case you don't have the disc. So so it is out there. It's readily available, folks, as a rental on all the streaming platforms.
Yeah.
Or you could get the Blu-ray, which has got, it's got nice, it's got an audio commentary by Alex Cox, and it's got an interview with the director, and it's got a sort of a retroactive sort of old sort of featurette about spaghetti westerns that was made around the time of the production. So that's kind of interesting as well.
Yeah.
And so it's a good little disc to pick up.
Mm.
So there you go.
Definitely.
Don't find it, folks. Right. So on that note, I think we're going to just take a little bit of a break.
Yep.
And I'm going to freshen up my lemon and ginger tea.
Good.
What's more Italian than that, Jonathan, I ask you?
Few things could be more Italian than lemon and ginger tea.
quite a lot, actually. But anyway, we're going to take a very short break, folks. But for you, it's only going to be mere seconds. And then we're going to be right back for the second half of our Spaghetti Western Double Bill. And we're going to be talking about the absolute masterpiece called The Great Silence.
Thanks for listening to the Film Swap podcast. If you like this podcast, please consider giving the show a rating or leaving a review. This helps other listeners find the show. You can follow the Film Swap on social media. We're on Twitter and TikTok at Film Swap UK, on Instagram at Film Swap Media, and on YouTube at Film Swap _podcast, and at Facebook at Film Swap The Podcast.
You my cowboy hat.
And we're back, and Jonathan's lost his cowboy hat. What a time to lose your cowboy hat. And you know what? We were talking, folks, on the break, because we were mentioning about Chuck Connors, and one thing that we actually missed was the fact that he played the heavy in Soylent Green, which is a film we talked about a while back, last year. We talked about Soylent Green on our epic eco-disasters film.
Yeah.
And we kind of missed that Chuck Connors was in that film as well. So this is not his first time on Film Swap. Well, gosh, I wish he would come on Film Swap. And sadly, he's no longer with us, but he'd be more than welcome to come on Film Swap. Just like Werner Herzog and Malcolm McDowell and all those guys, the door is open. Stacy Keach, the door is open, guys. Come and reach out to us, because we'd love to have you on to talk about some of your great work.
Absolutely.
But sadly, Chuck Connors will not be able to join us. But wherever he is, we loved Kill Them All and Come Back Alone and some of your other films. And, he's left a great legacy behind.
Yes.
So on that note, The Great Silence. Jonathan, take it away. Tell the listeners about, because we've gone from more of a fun sort of just sort of piece of entertainment from the spaghetti western, and now we're going into the something much more profound and amazing.
Yes. Well, the I would say Kill Them All is basically a sort of B movie. And whereas Great Silence is an A movie, and
A plus.
Well, it was definitely the sort of one of the headline film that night or that afternoon. And it's directed by Sergio Corbucci, who was one of the great sort of spaghetti western directors, probably, according to Alex Cox, one of the three Sergios. And the film came, I think it came out after Django, which is possibly his better known film, especially since Django Unchained, Quentin Tarantino's movie. And it stars the great, what's his name, Jean-Louis Trintignant, who is a terrific actor. I mean, he only died a few years ago, and he'd been in films from the 50s until, well, I think, when was that one about Alzheimer's that came out? Yeah. Anyway, he just went on and on and on. He made 146 movies.
That's just, oh gosh, and look, he's in The Conformist. I just saw him the other night in a film called The Sunday Woman.
Okay.
And as you mentioned, he was in our Christmas special when we talked about My Night at Maud's.
I mean, the last film that he was in came out in 2019. Yeah. And the first one was, I think, sort of 1952 or something like that. So he had this immensely long career, incredibly experienced actor. Really, he's thinking, you know, who is there like that in the sort of America or Britain? I mean, maybe Michael Caine? I don't know.
But anyway, he's a great, great actor, and he's amazing in this because he doesn't actually speak, does he?
He doesn't speak. So the great silence, I assume, because firstly, I'd like to say that one of the things I really like about this film is that it's all in the snow. And of course, yes. If you watch some John Ford Western, they're often in Monument Valley, somewhere very hot.
Yes.
And there might be a bit of snow every so often. But this one is sort of further north up the Rockies. And it's just sort of, and in fact, it's not just in the mountains and the sort of snowy, it's in the great freeze or the great blizzard of 1899 or something like this. Yes. So it's sort of, it's a snowy region, and it's an extra snowy sort of
indeed
time.
I definitely watching the film, you definitely really get that sense of like, man, I wouldn't have wanted to work on that film crew, because blimey, that must have been some like tough-ass conditions to make a film in.
That's true, but I think a lot of it, they did actually use shaving foam, apparently.
Oh, right.
That's what Alex
Cox there is says. A little bits where it's hard, because, I mean, in the film, it's constantly snowing.
Yeah.
And it's just this huge, barren, icy, snowy landscape, mountainous landscape.
Yeah, they did. They did
very much like sort of a character in the film, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's really, it's like perfect, because it really reflects what's going on in the film itself, doesn't it? It's like,
exactly. Well, you know, great silence, I guess. Well, I thought it was going to be the sort of the profound silence of the mountains, maybe, or perhaps, yeah. I guess the great silence is death, isn't it? But in actually, the great silence is that there's this, one of the characters is called Silence. And yes, I guess indeed. The great silence is like the great Fandango or something, is like the great silence. Yes. And he is another sort of outlaw. I mean, all Westerns are basically sort of, you know, outlaws are one of the principal sort of tropes, I guess.
And he's like kind of like a bounty hunter or something like that. Like it's all a lot of the characters in this are kind of bounty hunters, like sort of guns for hire.
Yes. The funny thing is, they're not normally, I'd say, bounty hunter. And I think I've always called them a bounty hunter. I've always heard them referred to as bounty hunters. But in this film, they're called bounty killers. Mm. Because they're not so much into the hunting, because bounty hunters, they might take you alive. These lot, there are these bounty hunters, they never take you alive. They just shoot you. It's much easier.
Yeah, well, yeah. Certainly in Klaus Kinski's case, he's a man in this film who has absolutely no moral compass whatsoever.
No.
He's completely and totally and utterly ruthless in every sense of the word.
Yes, and Klaus Kinski just is the perfect sort of character for this because okay, perfect actor. He's got these sort of ice cold, ice blue eyes, which
Yeah.
like sort of lumps of ice, sort of looking at these that is poor vac victims. And yeah, I wrote down he's spectral at one stage. And so basically, the sort of the you've got on one side the great Silent or Silence himself, the man called Silence, who's mute essentially, this cowboy, the goody, who is played by Jean-Louis Trintignant. And then there's Klaus Kinski, the baddie, whose name is it Tiger or
Well, it depends what version. Apparently, in the Italian version, he has a name that basically translates to tiger. And in the English version, he's called Loco, as
Yeah.
in presumably, like, he's loco,
It's
he's a
crazy.
loco,
Yeah, because the one I
crazy.
watched, he was, they called him Tigrero. Tigrero is.
Tigrero,
They
which
keep
is
calling
like
him Tigrero.
basically the tiger, isn't it?
Exactly. I guess his hair is sort of yellow, like a tiger. Maybe.
And again, he has that sort of ruthless sort of, hunter in nature who just basically, is just out for his own. I don't know if that's being fair to tigers, though, to be honest.
Well,
But yeah, this is he is an utterly ruthless character. And on the other side is the Great Silence, which I love that. Because his character sort of represents, he's the one character who is in the film who kind of up who stands for morality and sort of goodness, doesn't he? And sort of
he does, yes.
he's the one who's there to represent that. He's almost like you could almost say, because towards the end of the film there's even a sequence that's almost sort of like a Christ-like figure, like a sort of
Yeah.
he's shown to be in the sort of position of being like Jesus on the cross sort of thing, and he
Yeah.
sort of represents that sort of that good heart and on the side of kind of righteousness and
Yeah.
goodness.
It's
And that's why I kind of like the idea that he's silent, because he sort of represents that. The side of you hear that term, the silent majority, and
Right.
it's usually used, it's a politicized term that sort of kind of corrupt politicians use to refer to this so-called sort of majority that just happens to agree with them, but they don't, they're silent because they don't exist. But in this case, this one represents the great the silence of the real silent majority of people who are good-hearted
Yeah.
and have respect for one another and
Does his character change during the film? Because at the beginning he's more a bit more similar to Klaus Kinski, a sort of, a bounty killer out for his own sort of benefit. And then he's sort of won over, especially by the
Well,
victim, Klaus
sorry,
Kinski.
I would want to just respectfully disagree with you there, Jono.
No.
Because at the beginning, he's been hired by this group of, I mean, they've been basically run out of town. I don't know if they're sort of because they're kind of immigrants and they're
These
sort of,
the what do you call them? They're called the bandits. That's it.
Yeah, they call them bandits because they've essentially the plot of the film is that this group of people, and I guess they're all sort of either ethnic minorities or they're foreigners who've kind of emigrated from other countries and they've come in and moved into the area. And then through some dubious laws that have been laid down by the local sort of politicians, all these guys have been kind of run out of town. And they're sort of living on the outskirts of the town out in the wilderness. And they're struggling to survive. They're trying to scrounge out a life. And the local vendors and sort of politicians in the area have sort of hired these bounty hunters to go out and kill these guys. They've put bounties on their head and said, yeah, you can go out and kill these guys and we'll pay you to get rid of them.
Yeah.
So it's this really corrupt and horrible sort of circumstance. And silence is basically protect them from the other bounty hunters.
Yeah.
So, in a sense, he does still represent sort of, he's defending the weak and the defenseless.
Yeah. So it's a bit like the sort of Magnificent Seven, isn't it? And High Noon? High Noon is sort of standing against these sort of people who've sort of taken over the town.
And they're all corrupt and they're villains and they're all just stealing and killing and being nasty. And he's there to help defend those people. And then what transpires is one of them, one of the local townsmen who's an African-American who lives in the town gets murdered by Klaus Kinski's character.
Yeah.
And his wife hires the silence to get revenge for her.
Yes.
But he's not really interested in the money or any of that. He takes the job really in the sense that he can see that there's been this injustice.
Well, it's not quite that simple, because he does have personal motives as well, because it turns out that one of the main characters behind all these, the people hiring the bounty killers, as they're called, is basically the person who's responsible for his muteness and his whole sort of situation. It's Henry Pollicutt, and he sort of runs the main store and is a sort of banker as well. And he is, it turns out, has basically hired the people that killed Silence's parents. Mm-hmm. And also these same people cut his throat, and that's why he can't speak.
Wasn't he the one who does it? I mean, we don't want to spoil any of the major plot points for who haven't seen it, but let's just say, yes, there is a sort of a bit of a personal vendetta.
There's a personal vendetta as well, exactly.
Yeah.
He is sort of hired, but I feel like he's not entirely engaged with his job of taking down the baddies. I don't know. At least he's not as successful as the cowboys I've watched in most films, like in the set Magnificent Seven, where they sort of take out the baddies who are coming to menace the town. And he's sort of, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, the film plays with these sort of tropes of the kind of with American Westerns where John Wayne rides into town, or Gary Cooper or whoever it is, and they're sort of a bit...
They're sort of invincible.
Yeah, they're kind of... They sort of mop up, and they might have a little bit of a setback just for dramatic effect. But generally speaking, these guys, they whoop the baddies and get the better of them, and they're the heroes, and they ride off into the sunset at the end. But this film kind of plays with all that, because... It's infested with that ambiguity, like you talked about, that it's not everybody's all clear cut good guys and bad guys.
No,
the film very much talks about the corruption and the politically about, it has that scene towards the beginning where, I don't know, is he like the governor or he's some sort of a local politician? And he sends the Frank Wolf character, who's kind of like a lawman, and he kind of says, I want you to go and all this stuff with all these bounty hunters and all this, it's becoming really unpopular. So I need you to go and stop these guys and clean up the town and put an end to all this stuff, because it's making me look bad and we got an election coming up,
right,
kind of thing. And it's very much kind of reminds you of sort of current circumstances right now. It's sort of like, because it all gets laid bare when, you've got massacres going on and they're kind of enabling it until it starts to look bad and people are sort of getting more and more upset about it. And then they kind of go, oh, well, maybe we better try and put a stop to this, or at least make it look like we're trying to put a stop to it. So it's that kind of, you know, there's that real sense of the kind of corruption and the violence that's used by, you know, politicians and business leaders and things in order to get what they want. And yeah. How they sort of marginalize people and are used quite brutal and ruthless tactics to do that. And this film kind of lays that all bare and quite openly sort of shows it. And I think that's what makes it really quite interesting, because it kind of doesn't hold any of that back, and it doesn't sort of sugarcoat anything or make it. It's very sort of brutal and succinct. And also, I mean, I'm quite intrigued what you thought about the ending. I think it's important that we really try hard not to spoil it for someone who hasn't seen the film.
Yes.
But I think it's quite a powerful and unexpected ending. Is that the best way of putting it?
Yes, I guess so. Actually, the interesting thing is you almost have a choice of endings, because on the Blu-ray, you've got alternate versions. So
there's two alternate endings on the disc, isn't there, which is quite interesting.
Exactly. Or even three, if you consider there's another one which has Alex Cox's sort of voice commentary on it as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's two alternative. So I guess you can sort of guess which.
Well, it's interesting, the story about that, because apparently the director filmed all these alternate endings because he wasn't sure how the distributor was going to respond to the ending that he wanted to use.
Yeah.
And so so he filmed these alternate endings in order to, you know, so that if they just so totally said, well, we're not releasing that because that's, you know, we can't have that.
Yeah.
So he had these other versions ready that he could just say, okay, we'll take that off and slap this on instead, sort of thing. But in the end, it did get released as intended.
Yeah.
And the film, oddly enough, never played in the United States.
Well, it's interesting because it got bought by 20th Century Fox, didn't it? And they sort of sat on it, basically. But apparently it did get shown in other territories around the world where they showed alternate endings, apparently. That's what I think the booklet said. The ending that he gave is sort of in line with his with the rest of the film. It sort of makes sense with the sort of poetically, politically for the rest of the film. And yeah, it's a powerful ending, quite shocking.
Apparently it was conceived as an allegory for Che Guevara.
Yeah, and Malcolm X. Yes, exactly. Yeah, so, which is amazing. Interesting.
So it's maybe not surprising that the film didn't receive a release in the United States. It did, as you said, 20th Century Fox purchased the distribution rights for America, but they chose, for whatever reason, not to release it. And I think Alex Cox had mentioned something about Clint Eastwood, oddly enough, who'd sort of was interested in doing a remake of it, but that didn't come to pass for whatever reason.
He did use elements of it in this film, Joe Kidd, that's it. So the character has the same gun as Silence in Joe Kidd, apparently. I've never seen Joe Kidd, so I don't think it's one of his better films. But
well, it's interesting. One thing I found really interesting was in watching this time, is that I found a lot of parallels too in terms of the storyline to another film that we talked about last year, which was Heaven's Gate, because
it's quite similar.
Yeah, the actual kind of plot line is very similar in terms of the politicians hiring and sort of legalizing these bounty hunters to go out and put prices on the heads of these immigrant farmers and things because they wanted to run them off the land for commercial reasons.
Yeah.
And so they used whatever flimsy pretext that they could to justify going out there and massacring these people.
Yeah.
And so the two films share very similar sort of basic plot points.
Yeah.
And it'd be quite interesting to know whether Michael Cimino was aware of this film, because if it hadn't been released in the United States, you know, it's quite possible maybe he didn't see it.
Yeah. Yeah, I wonder. But
maybe then again, you know, sometimes people could end up seeing things and maybe if he was abroad and he saw it. And
well, the funny thing about it is, you know, well, it's not surprising it wasn't released, but I also feel like this is just the sort of film that would have gone down very well in the 60s. It's a very 60s film. It would have gone down very well with some students, the same people who were watching, you know, Bonnie and Clyde and Easy Rider and everything. They'd have absolutely loved it. But
I mean, I agree. I think so. And obviously, subsequently, it has become, a very well-regarded film and a bit of a cult classic. And but I think it's still not massively well-known to a kind of a more general audience. I think it's more of a sort of a cineast kind of, popular amongst sort of cinema buffs like us. But but maybe not sort of, generally speaking.
It's not like, the Sergio Leone films, which are very well known by pretty much everybody, even though the music is also done by Ennio Morricone. Ennio Morricone.
Morricone, I mean, again, like his extraordinarily prolific composer, wasn't he? He's done scores for so many films, including White Dog, which is another. We're doing a lot of connections tonight to previous episodes and previous films that we've talked about.
Yeah,
Ennio Morricone did the.
He did
soundtrack for White Dog.
Yeah, music. Yeah. Well, old Alex Cox said it wasn't released in the UK either. The Great Silence. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the first time anybody, he said he had to go on his sort of in the extra on the Blu-ray, he said he had to go to get on the ferry and go to France to watch it.
That's something.
And in fact, he was the person responsible for it first being screened in the UK, but not screened in the cinema, screened on TV, because he used to run this show.
Movie Drone,
which I used to love. And he showed it on that, but I don't think I saw that one. I mean, by the time he retired in the sort of 94 and handed it over to Mark Cousins, I think he'd shown like 120 odd films or something. So I didn't see all of them. But anyway, he gave a little introduction, which I think you can find on YouTube from 1990 when it was first shown.
Oh, okay. Oh yeah, that'd be worth looking at. Alex Cogg, he's always got some interesting things. I mean, it's interesting because he doesn't seem to really make a lot of films anymore.
No,
he just seems to spend a lot. You know, he just writes books and does sort of commentaries and things like that now, but sort of as a film historian more than a film
maker nowadays. He works in a Colorado university or something like this. Lives in the States. It lives in a very snowy part of the States as well, I think, up in the mountains in Oregon. That's one of the things I wanted to say about the film is that it's very 60s, and all the sort of actors are dressed like sort of 60s or even 70s rock stars with sort of like fur coats. And and I like these, as I mentioned earlier, I really like sort of westerns in the snow. Things like McCabe and Mrs. Miller and sort of Grizzly Adams. And I don't know, there's something about just sort of crunching through snow in 19th century outfits that just goes quite well as far as I'm concerned.
Indeed, indeed. And I mean the whole the landscape and the weather and everything plays such an integral part in the sort of the overall kind of bleakness of the film and of the situation, isn't it? Like the, you know, it just, you know, really gives it that atmosphere, that sort of oppressive kind of, you know, atmosphere that just really makes it so effective.
I think it's
visually effective.
Beautiful. And, it's got so many beautiful scenes in it as well. There's these sort of close-ups of all these faces, and there's looking through the window, sort of framed by this sort of.
Yeah, I love some of those the close-ups of moments, because they're still there's sometimes when they'll do these really tight shots on their eyes and stuff, and sometimes it'll even be sort of slightly out of focus and they'll be walking and stuff, but it adds so much to the rhythm and the sort of the mood of it. And it's absolutely brilliant.
And
I was quite intrigued by the actress who played kind of Silence's sort of love interest, I guess. They kind of developed a relationship. She's the wife of the man who gets murdered in the town by Klaus Kinski. And her name was Vonetta McGee.
Yeah.
And I'm not massively familiar with... Oh, she was in Shaft in Africa, Blackula.
Yeah.
So she was the Eiger Sanction, sorry.
Interestingly, Alex Cox, again, sorry, it's a bit of an Alex Cox love-in tonight. So he was such a fan of her in this film that he cast her in Repo Man.
Was she in Repo Man as well? Yeah, I love Repo Man.
Yeah,
but she was really, really good in this. I mean, she's a lovely woman as well, and just really was an interesting character. I think really complex
absolutely. It's got amazing sort of scenes. One great one is the potato shooting scene, which I really love.
With Frank Wolf. I mean, we haven't really talked much about him in this, because in the first film we talked about, he's in that. He's one of the major characters in that film, and he's kind of the villain of the piece. It's hard to say that film has good guys and bad guys, because they're all, like a lot of spaghetti westerns, there are no good guys and bad guys. They're all sort of bad guys, but maybe a little bit good sometimes when it suits them. But in this film, in The Great Silence, he is very much a good character, isn't he?
Yes.
He's the new sheriff who comes into the town and tries to put a stop to all the nastiness. But he has a certain level of naivete about him, doesn't he? Because he's a good guy and he means well.
Yeah.
But he probably has a little bit too much faith in, you know,
others,
the law, and doesn't really understand the complexities or the, you know, how things really stand.
Well, he doesn't know how many people he's up against, really. He just thinks.
Yeah, exactly. And really, So again, a really interesting character.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really good element of it as well. And Klaus Kinski, we touched a little bit on the fact that he is just like an absolute nasty piece of work in this film. And an incredibly compelling, charismatic person. And whenever he's on screen, you can just, you know, he sort of personifies that kind of ruthlessness and that, you know, and very, very intelligent and manipulative in his actions and stuff. And he kind of weighs up things, and he's quite, you know, tactical in the way that he deals with various situations. So he's an incredibly interesting and complex character as well. Mm. So, the film definitely has a kind of an overall kind of bleak tone to it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's obviously still a piece of entertainment in the sense that it's suspenseful and riveting, and there's some good action sequences and things like that. But I think the general sort of thing about it that makes it so effective is just that kind of bleak atmosphere and that real sort of honest sort of appraisal of kind of human nature and politics and things like that. I think this film is quite profound in its examination of that. Those ideas. And I think that's one of the reasons what makes it kind of special, because it's quite powerful.
Yeah, it's definitely one that you should watch if you like Westerns and like the films of the principal actors and Quentin Tarantino. If you're sort of interested in his influences, this is, I think, one of his, I mean, he's got so many influences, but I think
he does indeed. It's almost like you can't watch any sort of great genre films now without someone having to say, it's got Quentin Tarantino's stamp of approval, so this is worth checking out because Quentin Tarantino likes it.
Yeah, well, I think that's fine. I mean, he's an extremely creative and sort of interesting guy, and he's a filmmaking David Thompson in a way. He's sort of seen every single film ever, it seems like.
Yeah. And he brings it all in and sort of, you know, stirs it up and presents it in a really, you know, compelling and entertaining way.
Yeah.
I'm not clear on Quentin Tarantino, what he's often in his films. I'm not 100% clear what exactly it is, the point that he's trying to make in a lot of his films, especially when you think about things like Inglourious Basterds and Django Unchained, you know, very entertaining and compelling films in a lot of ways, but I often walk away from them kind of wondering exactly what is the point that he's trying to make with this? What was he trying to say?
Yeah, well,
exactly. I'm never quite sure. Maybe other people are. I certainly think I know what Grand Silence is, the Great Silence, or he was trying to say.
Yeah, I guess they're different sort of character. You know, his Quentin Tarantino is much more postmodern, isn't he? And this is not sort of postmodern. This is, it's a 60s film, and he's got his sort of 60s radical vision, I guess. But yeah, anyway, definitely worth watching.
Well, and definitely, like you say, people, when they think about spaghetti westerns, they probably always think about those Sergio Leone films and things like that. So these are some sort of alternative films that you can go check out if you want some good quality films in that sort of subgenre of the western, and to check them out. They're really worthwhile.
Yeah.
You mentioned about the Blu-ray. Masters of Cinema from Eureka Entertainment. They have a really, really great Blu-ray set. Mine's got the little sort of cardboard slipcase around it, but it's the same thing.
Okay,
basically it's really good because aside from the film, like we mentioned, it's got like sort of alternative endings that you can look at. And it's got a discussion from Alex Cox talking about a little bit about the background of the film and the history of it.
Yeah.
And it's got lots of really interesting contextual stuff on it that makes it worth picking up even after you've watched the film. There's lots of other stuff on there. I think you'd mentioned, Jono, because you had a look, and it's not really readily available on streaming at the minute.
Well, that's it. I mean, that's the other thing about why it's worth getting this, is because otherwise you can't watch it. Because basically there's no streaming, which is quite odd considering Kill Them All is available to stream, which I'm afraid is not on this level.
It is especially surprising when you consider the reputation that the film has, that it is a real classic, highly, highly regarded. But it's not very, like I said, it's not very mainstream well-known. And I think that's why it's worth us drawing people's attention to it and saying you should go and search this film out. I know there's an American Blu-ray as well. I can't remember who released it, but there is one out there. And again, in the United States, because obviously we're in the UK, so for our American listeners, the I don't know what the situation is in terms of the streaming, whether it's available on any streaming platform. So you would have to investigate that yourself, depending on where you find your films.
Is published by a company or produced by a company called Film Movement. Have you heard of that?
Oh, Film Movement. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
So there you go. So in America, you can there is a Blu-ray available. So folks, definitely worth seeking out and finding it. And hopefully that changes. I mean, obviously we're recording this in sort of spring 2024. Yeah. So if you're listening to this sometime in the future, hopefully that situation will have changed. And the film will be a bit more easy to access on a streaming platform or two.
Yeah.
But anyway, search it out, folks. We'd definitely love to hear from you. We'd love to hear what you think about The Grand Silence and Kill Them All and Come Back Alone. It's such a great title. It's a bit of a mouthful, isn't it? It doesn't exactly roll off the tongue, but it is a terrific title. Kill Them All and Come Back Alone. But anyway, it's a great, terrific, if you just want a really entertaining, fast-moving, totally action-packed adventure, Western adventure film, that's a really terrific film to check out. Mm. It's got a great cast, and it's a lot of fun. And drop us a line, and if you want to let us know some other great spaghetti Westerns that you think people should check out as well, by all means, drop us a line and let us know. Or comment on the video or the show or wherever you're getting us. Just drop a line and let other people know what other great films they should be looking out for.
Definitely.
Yeah. So, Jonathan, nice to see you.
Good to see you.
And we'll be back, I think, in a couple of weeks. We've got a couple of guests lined up, actually, in the coming episodes. So, folks, watch out for that. It'd be a good time to hit that follow button or that subscribe button, depending on where you're finding us. And come back and join us again, because we're going to be talking about some more really cool films with some really cool guests. And, you know, just being generally cool.
Very cool. Extremely cool.
Yeah, because nothing says cool like a couple of middle-aged film nerds. All right, folks, take care of yourselves, and we hope to see you again in a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Bye-bye for now.
Okay, bye.
Oh, the things these nerdy middle-aged men get up to.